Welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth. We have a very serious subject today, sexual assault prevention, what you can do about it to avoid being a victim, and what if you are a victim? God forbid, how do you deal with that? And it's something that I think is really important to women and men in our community because it is a huge risk. As was stated in the ADN by Brooke Moore on May 30th, Alaska is now the most dangerous state for women, and Anchorage is number two on Forbes' list of the most dangerous cities for women. Horrible shame for everyone who lives here, I think. But we're not going to try to figure out how to solve that today. What we're going to talk about is what we can do about it as individuals, how you keep safe and how you deal with these terrible dangers. And we're going to want to hear your questions. We've got a panel of experts in the studio who can really answer those very well. Keely Olson is the executive director of STAR, Standing Together Against Rape, which is an organization which really deals with the whole spectrum of this issue. Thanks for being with us, Keely.
Thank you so much for having me here.
Glenn Klinkhart is a retired APD detective and author of several books, including Finding Bethany, a True Crime Memoir, and A Cybercop's Guide to Internet Child Safety, and has worked in this area. And thank you for being here, Glenn.
Thank you, Charles.
And this is an issue that comes very close to home for you, I know, both as a from your professional life and in your personal life.
Yes, it's one of those things where I don't think I could get away from it if I tried, having essentially had to deal with tragedy in my family from the age of 15, growing up here in Anchorage. It's all I know is Anchorage and Alaska. And there's with all the wonderful things that we have here and the opportunities and the diversity that we have. And, you know, when I used to go out of state and tell people, you know, how wonderful it was, at the same time, I still in the back of my mind had to deal with the fact that, you know, here I was the brother of a murder victim who was sexually assaulted. It was a sexual homicide. So, you know, even at the age of 15, the world came to a grinding halt. And that was this, you know, kind of the beginning process for me that led me to where I am now today, having to, in a sense, feel like, hey, there are ways to do this. Why did this happen to my sister? Why did this happen to me? And then when I became a detective, that became something that myself and other officers would oftentimes talk about and try to get to the whys. Because oftentimes, when you call the police, we're there after the chaos. I was once told by a very smart cop that what we do is we go to where there's chaos, we stop the chaos, and we write a report about it. Mm-hmm. And so oftentimes as an officer, you feel like you're just reacting, you're not fixing. So what are the things that we see either with dealing with the victims, the victim families, or when you're dealing with the suspect, what's going on in their heads or not going on in their heads we can glean some information to be able to say, this might be a better way.
So did that experience, that horrible tragedy of your sister's murder, did that bring you into the field of law enforcement? And you then spent a career in getting these guys and putting them in jail, right?
Absolutely. And for me, it wasn't a plan. I mean, if I was that smart, I probably would have bought stock in Apple back in the early 80s. But for me, it was just one of those things that my curiosity, my wanting to know, in a sense, learning how to, I got a chance to work with the behavioral profilers from Quantico, you know, although they don't like to be called profilers, by the way, it's behavioral scientists, and they are. Being able to look at the situation, be able to look at behavior, why they do it, how they do it, and help figure out, you know, is there ways to be able to not only solve the case, but also to be preventative, to be able to figure out ways that we can stop this. And so when I would interview suspects, I would go beyond just the confess, tell me that you did it. I wanted to know what was going on in their head and their hearts. And oftentimes that information I found was invaluable in trying to figure out how maybe we could keep ourselves and our loved ones safe.
Yeah. Well, I really want to hear more about that as we go on. I also want to bring in my other guest, though, Keely Olson from STAR, which is an organization that's been around in Anchorage for a really long time and has done a lot of great work and I think is very well known and well respected. And you've been there for quite a while. One thing I want to get on the table before we even go any further, though, is that when we talk about prevention and talking about being safe, we're not in any way saying that it's the victim's fault if they get raped. I mean, we should all be able to behave normally all the time and not worry about these things, but we do. So how do you sort of deal with that? I mean, there's always this suggestion when you say, well, you know, take these steps, that somehow it's the woman's fault or that it's a woman's responsibility, and it really shouldn't be.
Exactly, Charles. Thanks for bringing that to the forefront right away. There is always a concern when talking about prevention and how to be safer, that that's putting some culpability on the victim's shoulders, that there's something that they should know or should have been able to do to avoid being a victim in the first place, and that is just not the case. When we talk about prevention, we're talking about primary and secondary prevention, which starts at the pre-kindergarten level in reaching out to children and making them aware of body autonomy and who has, a right to have contact with them in private areas, and then how to identify trusted adults. And so we start with primary prevention and secondary prevention very early on in the Anchorage community, imparting that knowledge to children. But we look at prevention at more along the lines of how we can change a societal view and what perpetuates a rape culture and what makes our society so unsafe for women in the first place. And, you know, as we speak today, we're going to be talking along the lines of what is statistically accurate, and that women are primarily the victims of sexual violence, although, you know, sexual violence does not discriminate amongst genders, especially the younger the victim is for children. Mm-hmm. And perpetrators are going to be looking for vulnerability. So when we're talking about prevention efforts, we're looking at what may in particular make someone vulnerable, and then what kind of barriers can we put up to prevent a predator from taking advantage of those vulnerabilities.
Right. Yeah, a lot of interesting topics. The other thing that strikes me in this sort of stage setting aspect is something that I've become more aware of is there's been all this discussion about campus rape, date rape. When you hear from victims that say, well, I wasn't sure if I'd been raped, you know, and so is that part of prevention as well, as like making sure that people know that no means no, and that's really all it takes? I mean, what is rape?
Well, and it's not even as simple as that. It's understanding what consent is, that mm-hmm. consent is active consent. And there is a really wonderful way of explaining that as far as a video that I recently saw that talks about drinking tea. And it talks about if your friend says that they would like to have a cup of tea, and you get that for them, if they fall asleep, they may not want you to pour the tea down their throat.
Right.
So, you know, that is another aspect that we deal with sometimes here.
And you ask if you want sugar, and you ask if you want milk. I mean, you don't.
Exactly.
Don't make assumptions, right?
If the person says, no, thank you, I don't want the tea, then you don't try to force it upon them. You mm-hmm. don't follow them around with a cup of tea. And no does not equal try harder, which I think in our society, that has been confused. Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of prevention really has to get to the base idea of what is consent. And certainly that no means no, but when you're talking about someone who is incapacitated and not able to consent, that being drunk is not an invitation, for
right.
example, for someone to take advantage of them simply because they're vulnerable. And that's what I'm getting at with how do we, prevention is key to preventing potential rapists from taking advantage of those opportunities of vulnerability.
Yeah. Great topic. It's Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth. I'm joined by Keely Olson from Standing Together Against Rape and Glenn Klinkhart, retired APD detective and author of books on this subject. And we welcome your calls and questions on today's topic of safety and prevention regarding sexual assault. The phone number here is 550-8433, 550-8433. If you're outside Anchorage, you can reach us toll-free at 888-353-5752, and the email is hometown@alaskapublic.org. So I think it's important to define who the victims are and what the crimes are that are taking place, because we hear these statistics about how dangerous it is for women in Anchorage, but that doesn't mean that it's all just people being tackled on the Coastal Trail, right? Or, you know, that's a lot of different sexual assaults are taking place in different settings. And Glenn, maybe you could talk a little bit about that in terms of who is most likely, you know, to be the victim and perpetrator set, you know, in this. Is that something that statistically we can talk about?
Well, I think one of the problem, of course, is that with the statistics is that because it is a crime that is often underreported, that you have a very kind of thin line of what does get reported. And oftentimes, even within the FBI reporting, they have even thinner lines. And so I always try to be very careful about what the statistics are saying when it comes to the details.
So we don't know that much,
so
really.
So I don't think we do. Now, certainly, I think maybe Keeley might have some other statistics about it. But generally, I have found that it is something that goes across all socioeconomic. I mean, I've arrested people from engineers, vice presidents of companies, to homeless people.
Right.
And the victims have been also in all of those areas. And it's one of those situations where it isn't a poor problem. It isn't a rich problem. It isn't a homeless problem. I think at the end of the day, from dealing with a lot of the different suspects I'll talk to, is that the problem seems to be a cultural one. And it starts when you're young. It starts with our young men who are being taught, and they see how women are treated, how they're oftentimes treated as objects. Our media, you know, makes it so that it's all about, you know, how they look, how they act, what can they do for you. And for the men to be able to start to change that. And at the same time, you know, the idea of teaching our young women to be more empowered, to be able to know what those things, to become self-assured. And yet when they see in the media how they're supposedly going to, you know, supposed to act, and how men are allowed to, and being able to say no, be able to say no in many ways. One of the things I talk about in some of my lectures is that when you tell somebody no, oftentimes the suspects will take that as it's like you didn't even say it. And when I talk to some of these women, they'll say, well, but then I started thinking, well, then, you know, he didn't say anything, and he kept acting this way. No, you need to stop and say, wait a minute. I said no, not what you did or he did, but the fact somebody is continuing to do something when you said no. That's the point. That's the thing that you need to put in your brain. And of course, when these things happen, there's a million things going on. And for me, talking with a lot of the young people, it's about having this conversation before it happens. You know, having these conversations with what are you going to do if, what, you know, and making choices, being what we call situationally aware. I was recently asked to give a talk to a group of young women, and they said, you know, we'd like you to come talk to us about being safe. And it was clear what they were kind of looking at was either a physical class or I get people asking me, hey, Glenn, should I buy a gun or should I have a taser? Or right. should I learn karate? And even I found myself, even as a law enforcement officer, kind of getting into that. And yet when I stopped to do this class, this is about 5 or 6 years ago, I said, you know, if I'm going to teach these young people something, I don't think that giving them the same sort of it's a physical answer. I thought to myself, what kept me as a law enforcement, what keeps every police officer, every man and woman on the police force safe? And it goes all the way back to our police training, which isn't, sure, we have guns, sure, we have the taser, sure, we have physical training. But it was the idea of learning situational awareness, the idea of making choices and knowing that for every choice you make, there is oftentimes a reaction. And
which means, I mean, situational awareness, like when you're in a safe place and when you're not, and who's around you, and that sort of thing.
Think of it like, you know, kind of a Sherlock Holmes, or if you've ever seen the TV show Psych, where he is constantly looking at everything around him. And you wonder why officers, you can always tell when you do a class or you go to a place where there's cops, they're always sitting in the back of the room with their backs to the wall. You know why? Because they're looking at the situation. They're looking at who's coming and going. They're constantly, we play this game in our heads of learning to see what our potential dangers are and finding those risks. It's really a kind of a risk analysis. We all do it every day. We just aren't aware of it.
Boy, that sounds so... Sounds like such a bummer, you know, to think that you always have to be paranoid about somebody is going to, you know, jump you. I mean,
you know, but the fact is a lot of women that I work with on a regular basis are already paranoid.
Right.
They're paranoid, but they aren't situationally aware. And so we don't train girls and women to be situationally aware. And I think that, you know, Glenn makes a really good point that we are trained in our society to be accommodating, and we are trained to overlook something that may make us uneasy because it would be rude to bring it up. And, you know, that has to be overcome. Too polite. And that tends to be an issue in our society that is there's a gender difference there.
Especially for women, right?
Yes.
And perpetrators are very keyed into that and take advantage of it. And so exactly what Glenn was saying, if someone, you know, disregards no in a casual conversation, comes up to you, say at a bar, and offers to buy you a drink, and you're like, no, no, that's fine. And then they counter with, oh, come on, what would one hurt? You wouldn't want to be rude, that sort of thing. And they keep kind of gaming someone. There's a clear indicator that the person does not respect no, does not respect what your wishes are, and is more in tune with what their aim is than yours. But as a woman, I've been trained to really overlook that and put this person at ease and make them feel more comfortable and disregard what my gut is telling me.
Right.
And so
get your back up, be a little bit tough in that.
Exactly.
So what about safe and dangerous places? I mean, I kind of think I used to write travel guidebooks, and they always wanted me to put a section in about, well, where is it safe for women to be and where is it not safe for them to be? And you know, I think, well, you know, probably Spinard Road after bar break or downtown after bar break, you know, probably not so safe, but that's really not telling anybody too much. And then as I look at some of these statistics I looked at before the phone, before the show, a UAA Justice Center survey concluded almost 59% of women in Alaska had experienced physical violence, threats of it, or sexual violence from a partner at some point in their lives. So then I started thinking, well, maybe your own house is not so safe. So talk about that. Where is safe?
Well, statistically, sexual assaults are going to happen in your home, the perpetrator's home, or in a car. They're not likely to occur on the street, although they do. They're not likely to occur, you know, you're not likely going to be attacked in an alleyway, although that does happen. Statistically, you're more likely to be at risk in your own home or in an acquaintance's or friend's home.
So as Glenn says, making sure you have a pepper spray when you go running is probably not as important as making sure you're with the right people when you're in your own home.
Or making little things like only running with, if you're going to listen to music, you only have one earbud in. And that's not just to hear the person coming behind you, but the moose with the calf or the dog or whatever else, being aware of that. And it's those little things of just being aware of where you're at, where you're going, whether, because as you were kind of saying, you know, going to a place in Spinard may be safer than some other place, given certain circumstances and given things that you need to look at and analyze. I mean, the classic example is, you know, you are, let's say a woman is working late. It's an 8 or 9 o'clock at night. Well, is that January in Alaska at night or is that July? So the amount of light, what you can see, and you're, you know, the doors of the elevator open and there's a man standing there, somebody she's never seen before. And she gets that hair on the back of her neck. And that is a sense. And I talk about that in the classes. That is something that has been built into each and every one of us.
Pay attention to it.
Yes. And the idea is it's foresight, but we don't give a lot of credence to foresight. We all talk about hindsight. Oh, I knew. I mean, afterwards, we've all done that. Duh. I kind of had a feeling that might happen or something bad. Well, guess what? That is a sense. And we tend to ignore it because in this society, it's go ahead and give your uncle so-and-so a hug. Well, I don't want to. Well, you have to because it's polite. Or I'm going to get on that elevator with that person that I don't know. It's late at night. I'm the only one, and I don't want to feel like I'm going to embarrass myself or them. Or, you know, the problem is you've just now put yourself in a situation, which normally at noon with lots of people wouldn't be a problem. But now you've entered a locked, soundproof box, if you will. And that is, again, I'm not blaming the victim, but at the same time, looking at these clues and these things and saying, no, I'll catch the next one as you pick up your phone and you call somebody to say, hey, you know, come meet me, or having somebody come, you know, come with you, or giving yourself the ability to make other choices. Oftentimes when people get into these circumstances, they kind of narrow all their choices. As cops, I realized we're trying to create lots of choices. So that the chances are that if you give yourself choices, when it comes down to something bad happening, even beyond your control, you have choices.
Right. I want to go back to Keeley because I think I interrupted you. You were talking about the home setting a little bit and sort of what the issues are there.
Well, it could be an intimate part. Is a perpetrator of sexual assault. It could be an acquaintance, maybe a roommate's friend who is staying over and you are quietly in your own room and you don't lock the door because it's your home. And you wake up to being sexually assaulted. And that is more common than most people would think. And the idea that you were talking about people questioning sometimes for years, was I a victim of sexual assault? Was that rape? It's because there is not a clear idea of what is consent. And consent has to do with age. Consent has to do with it being active. And, you know, consent has to be, you have to be completely aware to be able to give consent. And I have heard people say this, that I woke up with my partner having sexual intercourse with me. That is not consent. There is no way to consent while you are sleeping.
Right.
And, you know, if somebody is incapacitated through their own use of alcohol or drugs, I think that that really blurs so many people's ideas of whether they were sexually assaulted or not. And it's terribly unfortunate because they question themselves, and that is exactly the situation that the perpetrator wants. They set up scenarios so that someone will question themselves and avoid reaching out for help, talking with authorities, and getting any kind of support. Mm-hmm. And that is where, if there is ever a question in someone's mind, I want them to call STAR. Mm-hmm. I want them to call our crisis line, and I want them to talk with someone. They never have to give their name. They don't have to identify themselves. But to be able to reach out to someone who is non-judgmental and doesn't know you and be able to ask just some simple questions to understand that, you know, that is not okay. And generally, the situation was a setup from the get-go.
Right. And this is all about prevention and education. And I want to get into what you were talking about, sort of like the services you provide and sort of after the fact, which is such a dreadful thing to think about, but it's really important. But before we get to that, you know, we had a debate in Alaska about whether we were going to pass a law called Aaron's Law, which would require school districts to provide education age-appropriate on sexual assault and safety. And I haven't actually read the law, but I've read certainly about it. And it sounds like that got caught up in all kinds of political machinations in Juneau and was changed so that it would sort of require an opt-in from the parents, which they don't even need now. And Governor Walker added it to the special session agenda. I haven't heard any discussion of it since the special session began. Let's start, maybe you start with it, Keely, in terms of what would Aaron's Law do for us? I assume that you probably support it.
Yes, STAR is definitely in support of it. I personally support it. I believe from firsthand experience that I've seen it work very effectively in giving children a voice and helping them understand what the societal boundaries are and what's appropriate and what isn't, and helping them understand that they have body autonomy and that no one should be touching them in private places. I think it gets caught up in being confused with reproductive education and talking about sexuality and all sorts of things that it doesn't. There's very easy ways to talk with children about those types of dangers and things that make them uncomfortable and give them tools about what to do if something like that should make them feel uncomfortable or they need to talk with someone. Political machinations is one of the nicest terms that I've heard about what has happened to Aaron's Law and Bree's Law, for that matter. Bree's Law is...
That's for the secondary students, right?
Yes, for mm-hmm. middle school and high school, for them to understand what the risks and dangers are of domestic violence and dating violence. I 100% behind that as well. These are things that parents don't know how to talk to their children about just naturally. It's not necessarily intuitive.
We don't have the information either.
And they don't have the proper mm-hmm. The proper information. So the old idea of protecting your child from somebody driving around in a van, handing out candy, or trying to get you to help them look for their dog, or jumping out from behind a bush in an alley is just so old and passé. It's not statistically accurate. It doesn't make sense. And so what you're working on protecting children from as a parent oftentimes doesn't work. Now, we will work with parents to help them understand how they can talk with their children, but it's not going to reach the scope that we need to reach for a societal change in, our state. And so we are working in the Anchorage School District by invitation, and we can go in and we can talk with children about in an age-appropriate fashion from pre-kindergarten through sixth grade is our primary focus, but we do pre-K through college years. For everything from child sexual abuse to dating violence to bullying to cyber crimes and that sort of thing. So there's a wealth of resources that are available in nonprofits dotted throughout the community that are available to schools that don't cost anything.
So we just need to bring them, yeah.
It's just setting it up to make it happen and not giving parents an opt-out to keep their children from getting that information. If we're going to start prevention right. and help them understand, and this is boys and girls,
yeah.
help them all understand. There are a ton of parents who will talk with their girls about safety, and they won't talk with their
right.
boys.
Let me give out the phone numbers, and then I want to ask Glenn Klinkhart to weigh in on this. The number here, if you want to get involved in our discussion, is 550-8433. Outside Anchorage, it's 888-353-5752. So that within the bowl, it's 550-8433. And email will reach us at hometown@alaskapublic.org. It sounds like you agree, Glenn, that really this prevention and teaching of kids is going to be a more effective way of dealing with the problem than strictly through additional law enforcement.
Well, really, as we started this conversation, I mean, any officer will tell you that if we can prevent something, you know, it's going to give us the time and resource to work on other things. And to kind of dovetail what Keely said is that we know from a law enforcement standpoint that when a child is sexually assaulted, we don't have to look very far for the suspect because 85% of the time it's a family member or a close family friend. And when I give talks and I mention that, even in the cyber crime classes that I teach, I think it's important that we tell parents that and kids that just because you're familiar with somebody, that still means that you have that right to be able to say, you know, what you do with your body, who can touch, who can, what is, and have that conversation. Because when you don't have the conversation, that's where the bad guys, if you will, the people that are going to take advantage of you, they know that and they work with that. They will take advantage of your kindness, of your confusion. They know that. They actually will leverage that against you for mm-hmm. all kinds of different ways and different reasons. And oftentimes it is the victims that aren't aware and haven't had that conversation. And yeah, I recently sat down and watched a very good documentary called Misrepresentation. With my son, I thought it was maybe more directed towards women, but it basically talks about society and how women are misrepresented and the idea that because of certain things, by the time girls get to be in high school, they've almost changed the kinds of things that, you know, they start believing that and being told and really having these huge dreams of wanting to do these other things. And by the time they get into high school, all of a sudden there's been a change. And the way that boys talk about girls, and it opened up a conversation with my son that I had never had, which is how do you and your friends talk about girls? How do you talk not just to them or how you treat them, but also how do you interact? And are you willing and able to stand up when one of your friends says something or does something inappropriate and being able to look out for each other?
Right.
And it's a cultural thing. And I kind of compare it with what organizations like MAD have done over the last 30 years. It's taken when I went to college 30 years ago. There wasn't a designated driver. It was kind of mad crazy.
Right.
Now, having conversations with college students, I see that things have changed. They're still not perfect, but now there does seem to be, because of these programs, because of the mm-hmm. conversations, we're more aware that now it's less likely that these young people, they actually go, of course we have a designated driver, or we're not going, or we're going to stay right
but
here.
But do either of you guys have a sense of why a proposal that seems to have such broad popular support would not just be a slam dunk? Many other states have passed it. I mean, do you want to weigh in on that at all? I assume, Glenn, you're in the same position that you support it.
Well, I certainly do, because any education, anything that opens up the discussion and gives people, when you give knowledge and education,
I guess
you give power
saying, who's
and
who's
options.
Against it, right?
Well,
why be against
it? And that's where I want people to stand up and go, you're either for or against it. You know, you've got to make a decision, and it isn't about who can get the best position and who gets the most money or whatever's going on with everybody. They need to stop it. You know, one of the things about now being a retired detective is I actually get to have an opinion. And I'll tell you right now, it's stupid. These people are being stupid. And for what? For to get a position, to get it? No, this is about what's doing what's right. And if you want in 30 years for us to be in a place where our young people aren't afraid of each other and that people will be able to understand something, a concept of giving somebody tea when they're asleep, then that's what we need to do. We got to start now. We got to start with this conversation, and anything else is just asinine.
All right. Good. Well, that's a good place for us to take a break. It's Hometown Alaska. That was Glenn Klinkhardt, author, former APD detective. Keeley Olson from Standing Together Against Rape is also with me. My name is Charles Wolforth. We're going to take a break for a couple of minutes, and when I come back, I'll give out those phone numbers and email for you to get on the air with your thoughts on the subject of sexual assault and your questions about how you and your family can be safe. So stick with us as Hometown Alaska continues.
The American Red Cross raised almost $500 million after the 2010 earthquake in Haiti. NPR went to Haiti to find out how they spent it.
They never had a real plan for what they wanted to do in housing.
We still have tents. People should not be living like this still.
That story later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen on alaskapublic.org.
This is Charles Wolforth. Recently, a friend told me about a pair of French cyclists who came through Anchorage on a tour of all the continents of the world. On the next Outdoor Explorer, meet this charming middle-aged couple, a CPA and a postal worker, who took off from Grenoble without a plan and have crossed Europe and Asia and plan to cross the Americas and Africa before getting home. We'll talk about cycle touring in Alaska, too, the best routes and tips for your own trip. Join us Thursday at 2, repeating at 9 on KSKA Anchorage. We're back. It's Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth. Our topic today is sexual assault safety and keeping yourself and your family safe. And how do we learn to keep our society safe? How do we change the way we do things? It's turned into a little bit of a broader discussion. And I've got two wonderful panelists in the studio today. Glenn Klinkhardt, who's the author of several books on the subject and a retired APD detective, has put a lot of these guys in jail. And Keeley Olson, who helps victims and tries to prevent sexual assault at Standing Together Against Rape. And we'd love to hear from you if you want to get on the air with us with questions, comments, or opinions. The phone number here is 550-8433, 550-8433. Outside Anchorage, it's 888-353-5752. And email is a good way to get on the air with your questions and comments. hometown@alaskapublic.org. Easy, hometown@alaskapublic.org. Glenn, you were talking about the work you have done over the years in figuring out who the perpetrators are, what kind of people commit rape, and can we recognize them? Is it someone, obviously they come from all kinds of socioeconomic levels, they come from all kinds of jobs and positions, but are there characteristics that we can use to sort of think about, you know, prevention and safety?
Yeah, and unfortunately, it's not an easy answer. I mean, everybody wants the easy button. You know, there's not an app for that. You can't, you know, take a picture and say this is, because unfortunately, I think that we all kind of, and I'm certainly have this problem, is that the movies, TV, we all have this idea of the you know, the mad rapist, somebody wearing black or whatever your own perception of it is. Once you get into things like advocacy or law enforcement and counseling, you you understand there's more to it. One of the larger ones that I've seen is what we call the situational rapist, which can be anybody. I mean, you put anybody in a certain circumstance, in a certain situation, and they may act, given the right precursors, the right situation, they might take advantage of that. And what is it in their brain at some point that they're going to say? They themselves do their own risk analysis. They will look at the situation and they will go, risk reward. Because they will say, if I do this, what are the chances of me getting in trouble versus the reward of whatever they're trying to get out of it, whether it's sexual satisfaction or in most cases, it's really about control. It's about power or anger. And they're going to weigh that. So when it comes from the other side, when you're looking at it, you need to make choices to make sure that a situational person, somebody that you may very well know, is going to look at this and go, there's going to be a bigger risk or punishment than any sort of reward I'm going to get.
Uh-huh. You're going to get caught.
Right. There's going to be something that's going to happen, and it's looking for those things. If one of the resources, and I wish I actually got paid for the number of times I've given this book away or sold it, is I urge your listeners, guys, buy these for your lady friends, your girlfriends, your daughters. The Gift of Fear by Gavin DeBecker. And I'll say it again, The Gift of Fear by Gavin DeBecker. It's been out for over 15 years. He's updated it. He's a behavioral scientist. When I first read the book, it was the first time that I had somebody tell me specifically the things that I was seeing in these suspects. And it's written in a very basic way. It's not an academic type book. He's taken the time to actually interview, like I have, a lot of these suspects to say, okay, what were you thinking here? And just as Keely had kind of mentioned earlier, they look at the situation and they are constantly pushing buttons and trying to see something as simple as what we talk about is the indebtedness. The loan sharking is the term I believe he uses, where I do something nice for you, now you do something nice for me. And when you say no, there's this indebtedness. And we as normal people, we all like to help people, you know, but it's better to owe than to, you know, to be owed than to owe. And unfortunately for a lot of women, they get in, you know, when they're approached by that, hey, I'll carry your groceries and I'll carry them upstairs. I'll help you load them in. And you're constantly, this person, he's doing this on purpose. There is a motive. He's creating a debt. And then oftentimes they will use these techniques where all of a sudden when you do say, well, that's thank you, but no, I've got them now. I'll go ahead and go up to my apartment. Or no, I don't need help putting them in the apartment. You need to look and see, why does he now want to get into the apartment? Is it just right. because he's being nice? Or again, he's pushing the boundaries. And if you've already said no, thank you, or no, he's still continuing. And you need to be aware that is a conscious decision he's making. And he's constantly checking to see risk, reward. Even if you do say no, he pushes a little bit more. It is something that is intentional that they do, but unless you're looking for it, you'll hardly ever see it.
Yeah. Do you feel, I'm sure that, and I've interviewed, you know, as a journalist, interviewed people who have committed crimes, and they always have a ton of rationalizations.
Yes.
It's almost incredible how they can come up with these things. And I wonder, from your perspective, is any of that ever real? In other words, do they ever sort of convince themselves, oh, well, it was real, she wanted it or something like that? Or do you think that's always just something they say after the fact to try to cover themselves?
Very few times have I ever had suspects completely come clean. I mean, just what we call puking on you, you know. Every once in a while, you'll ask them a magical question and go, well, tell me why we're here. And the next thing you know, it just all comes out. But that, unfortunately, is the exception. The rule is they will tend to minimize. That's the big thing. They will minimize and rationalize as much as possible because that's how they got there.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going to use that same technique to try to get out of the trouble. And again, they oftentimes they will then a good defense is a good offense. They'll then blame the victim, and so I will oftentimes look for, are they taking any responsibility? Are they when they're telling you something? Are they saying, well, now that I look back, that probably was not the right thing to do? Was it? And you see it sometimes, but most often you have to really drag that stuff out of them because they don't see it as any big deal.
Right. It's Hometown Alaska. We're talking about sexual assault today, and that was Glenn Klinkhart, who's author of a couple of books on the subject, at least a couple, Cybercop's Guide to Internet Child Safety and Finding Bethany, a True Crime Memoir. And Keely Olson's also with me from Standing Together Against Rape. Keely, one of the things that we hear in the media is that being a victim is bad enough, but going through the legal system adds to it. And so people don't want to report rape or sort of get involved because they're afraid that they'll be humiliated or they'll be sort of dragged through a really tough legal system. And address that for me. Is that a reality, or is that a fear that's not based in reality? And I mean, for some people, is it rational to say, well, I'm not going to report it because I don't want to be involved in the courts?
Sure, it's absolutely rational, and it's absolutely an adult's choice in the state of Alaska to make a determination of what is right for them. And some people feel overwhelmingly that they absolutely have to report, that it is not only a duty to themselves for their own healing, but it is a civic duty. And other people feel exactly the opposite. And at STAR, we do not judge one way or the other. We have no preconception. And I cannot tell someone, and I've been asked, well, what would you do? And what I would do has absolutely no bearing on the subject, because the resources and the information and, what I have in my life is much different from anyone else's life. So I cannot tell anyone what is correct for them. What we do a lot at STAR on our crisis line and in person is help people understand the options available to them. Primarily, taking care of themselves and making sure that their body is okay and that they are in a position where they can start the healing process, where they can have someone to talk to about what has occurred. Sometimes that's all people want. But if they are interested in going through the reporting process, we're going to help them to every extent that we can to make that as comfortable an experience as we possibly can. And here in Anchorage, we have a team that responds to victims of sexual assault, and it is called the SART team, Sexual Assault Response Team, made up and comprised of advocates, forensic nursing specialists, and specialized detectives or troopers. And we have a wonderful facility that is not a clinical, terrible type of environment. It's a very welcoming environment. It's a very safe environment. It is a place to start the healing process. And the whole idea of a SART is that the primary member of the SART team is the victim, and they are driving the bus. They are telling us what
they
want.
Getting all the support they need from all different dimensions. Yeah.
Exactly. And, I hesitate to say it's all the support that they need. It's a starting process. It's a starting place.
It doesn't have to be. Yeah. It's not as people, I think, maybe think that some uncaring detective who is like hostile is going to be questioning them. It's actually a supportive group.
It is. Yeah. It is a very well-trained team that is responding, and they are treated with the utmost respect and dignity from everyone on the team from beginning to end, and given a lot of support and options, because it's not something that's going to be taken care of that day. It's a long-term sort of
situation.
A lot
of recovery to do, too. We've got so much to talk about, but we've got some callers and emails that I want to get to. Amelia, did you have a comment or a question?
Yeah, my sister was raped by a neighbor as a very young girl, and it wasn't the creepy uncle, and it wasn't the adult child molester that was in the neighborhood. It was a 15-year-old boy, and we hear, we see a lot in the media, or we've seen a lot of cases of adults that molest children. But what about young adults, young teenage, in this case, boys? What kind of things has the detective seen that might be something parents can watch out for?
That's a really good point, and I'm glad you brought it up, because it starts at even a very young age. I mean, we see inappropriate touching, inappropriate actions from kids at elementary level. And, again, there's no easy answers, but I think that it begins with us as parents understanding, asking the right questions, having those conversations in the home, at school. They have certain rules and certain respect things that happen. But I will say that one of the great things, and I want to kind of say some real kudos to STAR, to the organization. One of the things from a law enforcement standpoint that let's be honest, we weren't very good at it a few years ago, a number of years ago. It was a terrible, terrible thing to have a victim, you know, whether it's a child or an adult, come forward about a sexual assault allegation. And they were essentially thrown into this pit of, I have to tell the story 8 times. I have to deal with this several times. And from a detective standpoint, you know, we would be doing multiple cases. So you weren't really an expert at anything. You would kind of deal with it. And it might be, your experience would be generally which detective happened to be working that night or who was the low man on the totem pole. When this change happened, how many years ago would you say?
It's been a while.
15, 20 years?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Or even better, that we, and this is something that I think has been relatively unique to us to a certain extent. In fact, other places have looked at us as the model to have this team approach. So that you have, you know, so you have a nurse there who specializes in the medical, make sure you have the medical. You do have the detectives there who know how to talk to the kids, who know how to talk to the adults and how to talk to the suspects. Talking to a suspect who's a child is also different than talking to an adult. And being able to do it in one place where, yeah, there may be other interviews, but it's not a protracted 4-day 18 people have to deal with. It's really one of those things where we've learned from our own mistakes and from feedback from victims that this is a much better way to, you know, to deal with it, as well as to be able to educate and have, because you can't be an expert at everything. So having STAR, having that working environment. But back to Amelia quickly, is that the suspect and the motivations and all of that is still the same thing. It is still, can we change the way we treat ourselves and women? And how we treat each other. And again, having a law that actually helps start educating all of us at a much younger age can help, again, having people who are potentially suspects making better decisions later on, and avoiding, you know, two tragedies, if you will, where you've got then a juvenile suspect who is now looking at a sexual assault charge. Or I've even arrested teenagers as young as 14 years old for collecting child porn on the internet.
Wow.
You know, we've got that whole other issue of an unlimited amount of pornography and how that affects men and women's attitudes towards each other, that it's a huge problem. But at the end of the day, we really need to all stop and go, all right, how are we treating ourselves and how are we treating each other?
So, Amelia, does that cover it for you?
Yes. This happened back in the late 80s, early 90s. And yeah, there just wasn't the talk like there was at school. We all learned stranger danger and things like that. But we don't have this positive, we didn't have the positive talk about females in society mm-hmm. that we have now. Yeah. And I think that's a huge step in the right direction.
Right. Well, thanks for the call, Amelia. I want to follow up on it in terms of if you feel that there's somebody who seems a little creepy, you know, maybe a little too interested in kids or anything like that. Is there anything you can do about that? I mean, the cops aren't going to be interested in that kind of suspicion, are they?
Well, yes and no. I mean, what happens to most people, even I do this as a cop, you see something, you make observations, and then you start playing that person's just here for whatever reason. You know, we do it. I mean, we do it to ourselves. And what I like to tell witnesses, what I call them, is, you know, it's better to call APD, maybe on the non-emergency line, or if you think it's serious enough, you call 911. Officers, you know, especially here, certainly immediate chaos is going to get handled first, but suspicious people, suspicious circumstances, maybe a better term, we'd rather go and look, find out, is somebody supposed to be there? What is the reason? And oftentimes, again, all it is maybe having an officer have a chat with somebody and clear it up. Mm-hmm. But at the other time, you never know. That person may be a felon, may not supposed to be around kids, may have a warrant for their arrest.
Right.
And it, again, we kind of play this, I don't want to be embarrassed or I don't want to embarrass somebody else. But it never hurts to ask. And as long as you ask in a professional way or you make good choices, it's all about getting information.
Yeah. Keely, did you want to jump in on that?
I did. I just wanted to say that, our STAR educators are available to go out and talk with community members about concerns that they might have. And we have done that with different groups around town, whether it is an organization or a church or, a number of different places where they have concerns about someone who is... just seems to be maybe grooming children or has some sort of interest where we can go in and we can provide some training. And certainly calling the STAR Crisis Line may result in a report because we are mandated reporters and we take that as a solemn duty. So if we have any concerns, we can make sure that we are reporting that to the appropriate persons.
All right, good.
But in the meantime, somebody on the crisis line may be able to help someone troubleshoot. What can I do to keep my kids safer? Because I feel like this person could be a risk. And there are so many variety of things that can be tailored to your situation. We're happy to help.
STAR is a good resource for starting out on all this stuff. And you can find a link to STAR on our website, alaskapublic.org. Look at the sexual assault safety link. And you'll find a link to Detective Klinkhart's books too there. So we have some more emails that I want to get to. I also let folks know we have a few minutes left. If you have questions, the number here in the bowl is 550-8433, 550-8433. And here's an email from Elizabeth, who is with the UAA School of Nursing Program. Says that they've researched interpersonal violence prevention, including sexual violence, child abuse, elderly violence, and domestic violence. And they're holding a community fair to educate the public on this topic, teaming up with multiple Anchorage resources to reach the public on interpersonal violence prevention. This is Saturday, June 13th, so coming up in another weekend after next, in Town Square Park from noon to 6 p.m. And we'd love to for our community to stop by, check out what we have learned, and be entered to win big prizes from our raffles. We also received an email from a listener who really wanted us to talk some more about Aaron's Law and why we can't get this past the legislature in a clean bill. We kind of touched on that, but it sounds like there's a lot of interest in that subject and sort of consternation that hasn't passed. Keely, did you have a comment?
I don't understand why Aaron's Law is bucking up against so much political machinations, as you as you so delicately put it. I have not seen or heard a rational reason as to why people are opposing the law. They will point to the budget. They will point to different things like unfunded mandate. And I know that there are resources available to these schools. We go into the Anchorage School District on a daily basis and reach out to educate some 10 to 15,000 students a year at no charge to the Anchorage School District, and we do it because it's the right thing to do. But we have to be invited in. It's not a mandate. It's not something that is required. And, ASD is not in the norm as far as schools throughout the state. So that information is not getting out there. And so it's not making the state a safer place to be.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and I've been involved in passing several laws, including a number of years ago our child porn law that we have here. And the experience was, for me, was a relatively good one. I mean, I spoke to some people. We said, here's what we need. We did some – I went to a couple committee hearings, and there wasn't anybody who voted against it. It wasn't – and so the experience for me was good, which is why I have a hard time fully understanding what's going on in this case, especially when something like this – again – education is what it's all about, but changing the culture so that 30 years from now, we're going to be having a different conversation when the three of us sit down. Because from what I see, especially from law enforcement, is that it affects not just the idea of sexual assault, but also, just being kind to each other, but also bullying, sexting, which is a huge problem here. We are here in Alaska. We are been wired for 15, 20 years. We have more internet connectivity than most any other place in the country. Or just harassment, email harassment, and all of these things are all tied in together. And if we're going to solve these problems, there's no easy button, but it all begins with the conversation. And if you're stagnant the conversation, then there's going to be no movement forward.
Right.
So why aren't we talking about it?
Yeah. Got another email on the topic from Representative Garen Tarr, and she's requesting that folks who want more information about her law can contact her office. So that's a resource out there for people who want to know more about it.
And Garen certainly was the first to introduce, pre-introduce the bill this session. And there were four identical bills introducing Aaron's Law this session. It's definitely a bipartisan issue. And it's just gotten
caught up in some kind of some kind of thing that we don't understand. So we've got a few minutes left, and I wanted to, you know, there's been a lot of discussion in the media about false accusations of rape coming out of the Rolling Stone article about University of Virginia, where there was a sensational account of a gang rape, essentially an accusation without naming the people involved, but everyone knew who it was, and it turned out that it was not true. And I'm just wondering if obviously there are going to be false accusations of every kind, I guess I'd like to maybe put those in context of what percentage of these accusations turn out to be false or unfounded or can't be substantiated, as opposed to the number of crimes that are actually taking place, so that we can, when we hear these claims, we can kind of put it in perspective. Who wants to take that question?
I will start, but okay. I'm sure Glenn has something to offer as well. I just wanted to state that, you know, the case of Rolling Stone, that was a case of very poor journalism and journalistic ethics to a large extent. It was actually re-describing a gang rape case that actually occurred previously and had been written about, and it was found to be almost verbatim to be taken from someone else's true experience that happened years prior.
I see.
I would say that by national accounts, the statistics would indicate that there is anywhere from 2 to 8% of cases are considered to be could be false reports. It's very, very different to say that a case is unsubstantiated, and I'll let Glenn talk some more about that. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, this has you can't find the evidence doesn't mean it didn't happen.
Right, but it's a double-edged sword, too. I mean, it's one of those things where from an investigative standpoint, you know, we go in there, a good investigator is going to be neutral and objective, and they're going to find out the facts. And unfortunately, in areas like this, especially child sexual assault, it's a very emotionally charged situation. But the world is gray, and that's the best thing I can tell young detectives is remember, things are gray, and your job is to just find out the facts, turn those cards over, and see what, at the end of the day, what do you have? And a good investigation is going to include everything. You don't just like, you know, you don't just take the victim's word for it, not because they might be lying, but because of memory, because of alcohol or drugs or other things. And then you also have the duty to find out all the other information, whether it's cell phone records, whether it's the other witnesses, videotapes at the location, and then of course talking to the witnesses and the suspect, and making sure that you do an investigation and an interview that is going to elicit the information that's going to either support or it's going to show that they're not telling the truth.
Right. Right.
You know, it's just a lot. There's just a lot going on. If you do your job right, those sort of things will be minimized.
And we have to finish up there. It's been a really interesting hour. Listeners who want to learn more should go to our website, alaskapublic.org, where you'll find a link to STAR, which is probably the best place in the community to get the information you need. Also, books by our guest, Glenn Klinkhart, Finding Bethany, A True Crime Memoir, and A Cyber Cop's Guide to Internet Child Safety are available. Thanks for being with us, Glenn. And also thanks for being with us, Keely Olson from STAR.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So our audio engineer today was Dave Waldron. Pat Yak is the director of content here at Alaska Public Media. Grace Bojean is our production assistant. My name is Charles Wolforth. Thanks for joining us on Hometown Alaska.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.